content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 4th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. China's crash triggers market correction. What happened? Fears of a Chinese economic meltdown sent U.S. and global stock markets tumbling into turmoil this week, with the Dow Jones plummeting 1,100 points in a matter of minutes before regaining some of what was lost. Amid signs that growth in the world's second biggest economy is slowing, the benchmark Shanghai Index tumbled 16% in 3 days, continuing a two-month decline that has seen Chinese equities lose half their value. The Dow, the S&P 500, and other major indexes around the world responded to China's crash with a panicky sell-off, fueled by fears that a major market correction was overdue. U.S. stock markets lost $2 trillion of value over several days. Overall, global equity markets lost more than $5 trillion of value. Commodity markets, including oil prices, also went into steep decline. Many analysts say the U.S. stock market decline meets the historic criteria for a correction, a 10% drop that recalibrates swollen prices, and predict a gradual recovery after another month or so of volatility. But former U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers warned the Fed and other policymakers that confidence in the global economy was weak and that a major prolonged sell-off similar to 2008's was possible. We could be in the early stage of a very serious situation, he said. What the editorial said. The big stock sell-off was one of the most widely anticipated corrections in recent memory, said BloombergView.com. China has provided almost half the world's economic growth in recent years. That was never going to last, and now its exports and manufacturing are in steep decline. Meanwhile, Europe's recovery from the 2008 financial crisis has been feeble. Weak global demand has depressed oil and other commodity prices, hammering many emerging market economies, and equities have become hugely overpriced. Market corrections were probably overdue. The danger is, once they start, they're apt to get carried away. Now it's all eyes on Beijing, said the Financial Times. Having spent months encouraging the public to buy stocks, the government has at last realized it can't prop up markets forever. China's long-term plan to rebalance its economy away from exports and toward domestic consumption is a sound one, but doing so amid severe market turmoil won't be easy. Whatever Beijing decides, it needs to make its conclusions and intentions public, because the global economy is now deeply interconnected. Markets and the wider world need confidence in the existence of a plan. What the columnist said. Is this the start of the next global recession? Asked Noah Smith in BloombergView.com. Will U.S. markets catch the disease, dropping into bear territory, a 20% decline? It's very unlikely. Few American companies are dependent on selling to China, and U.S. banks are relatively unexposed. And with Beijing desperate to keep exports humming, American consumers will keep getting a flood of inexpensive Chinese goods. Here's some advice to the tens of millions of Americans who are invested in the stock market, said Ben Castleman in 538.com. Do not sell. No one can predict when the market will regain its lost value, but every correction and crash has been followed by a rebound. Only by riding this out will you avoid big losses. The Fed now has a crucial decision, said Neil Irwin in NYT.com. After nearly 7 years of keeping interest rates near zero, the central bank's officials had signaled that they'd be raising them in September. Will this market turmoil change their minds? Probably, though the Fed might not want to appear to be overreacting to market fluctuations. Whatever the Fed decides, expect a big reaction from global markets. Even if U.S. stocks climb back in coming weeks, said Rana Faruhar in Time.com, the boom of the last few years is officially coming to an end. Fueled by debt, central bank dollars, and China's bubble, the markets have offered huge returns during a six-year-long bull market. But that largely artificial boom couldn't last forever, since it wasn't accompanied by truly vigorous economic growth. As the markets adjust to reality, be prepared for much more volatility. And a second main story today, U.S. heroes foil attack. The French are this week hailing as heroes three young Americans who sprang out of their seats on a high-speed train to tackle and subdue a suspected terrorist who had enough ammunition to slaughter hundreds of people. The crowded train was an hour outside the French capital when Ayoub El-Kassani, 26, a Moroccan national and jihadist sympathizer, suddenly pulled out an AK-47. Marc Mougallian, 51, a French-American professor, grabbed the rifle, but El-Kassani shot him in the neck with a pistol. That's when the Americans, Alex Scarlatos, 22, an Oregon National Guard specialist, Airman First Class Spencer Stone, 23, and college senior Anthony Sadler, 23, went into action. Scarlato shouted, "Let's go," and Stone rushed El-Kassani, placing him in a chokehold as the Moroccan repeatedly slashed him with a box cutter. With the help of British passenger Chris Norman, 62, the men finally knocked El-Kassani unconscious. French President François Hollande awarded Norman and the three Americans the Légion d'honneur, France's highest decoration. The recovering Mougallian will be honored separately. "It was basically just gut instinct," Scarlato said. "We just kind of acted." These heroes charged when others cowered, and now a trainload of passengers owes them their life, said David French in NationalReview.com. "Such moments of courage make us a harder target and send our enemies a message. Americans still know how to fight." The incident inspired gratitude, but also a deep sense of vulnerability, said the New York Times in an editorial. Europe's vast and largely unprotected rail system will remain a prime target for Islamist terrorists until the continent introduces new security measures, including tight baggage and passenger checks. It's not enough to simply rely on the lucky presence of brave tourists. "We can't always rely on authorities either," said Mark Champion in BloombergView.com. "No intelligence service can monitor every potential lone wolf around the clock, so ordinary citizens will sometimes be the only defense when terrorists attack public places." Stone and Scarlatos, with their military backgrounds, knew what to do. But how many of us have their skills? Reinstituting a draft would be a vast overreaction, but somehow we have to make the training these American heroes received much more widespread. Our controversy of the week, immigration. Should the GOP follow Trump's lead? Thanks to Donald Trump, it's possible that the entire presidential election just got decided, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Most GOP leaders freely admit that a Republican can win the presidency in 2016 only if the party attracts a much greater share of the Hispanic vote than Mitt Romney did in 2012. But over the past week, Trump has pushed his panicky Republican rivals to the right on immigration by saying he'd deport all 11.5 million undocumented immigrants and end birthright citizenship, the constitutional provision that makes anyone born in the U.S. a citizen. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker said his views on birthright citizenship and immigration were similar to Trump's, and then backtracked to vaguely say he favored enforcing existing laws. Senator Marco Rubio, an anchor baby himself, said people coming to this country expressly for the purpose of having children is a legitimate issue. Jeb Bush, who is married to a Mexican immigrant, shocked Hispanics by using the offensive term anchor baby and then doubled down by saying it's a bigger problem among Asian people. What a disaster. Hispanic voters just heard louder than before than ever before that the GOP doesn't like them and doesn't want them. Republicans do need to be careful, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. The other candidates shouldn't be echoing Trump's barstool bombast about mass deportations, but surveys show that most Americans feel they are losing jobs to immigrants. And the success of Trump's campaign shows it would be smart to take a sledgehammer to the lazy establishment consensus on immigration. Trump's plan really isn't so crazy, said D.C. McAllister in TheFederalist.com. Other than Canada, we are the only advanced nation to grant birthright citizenship. That might explain why there are now 4.5 million of these birthright kids in the U.S. A whopping 73% of Americans don't think illegal immigrants' children should become citizens at birth. So why is the idea of ending this practice somehow out of the mainstream? Because birthright citizenship is in the 14th Amendment, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. Repealing birthright citizenship would require a years-long struggle to amend the Constitution. It's just as unlikely to succeed as the proposal to deport 11.5 million people. And for Republicans, both proposals are political poison. Hispanics, the growing Asian American population, and moderate independents are all turned off by blatant anti-immigrant sentiments. At the moment, Republicans look to have an excellent chance of beating the flailing Hillary Clinton. Do they really want to be dragged into a stance that would make that prospect electorally impossible? Party leaders admit they're very worried, said Molly Ball in TheAtlantic.com. Trump has blasted open the GOP's long-standing fault lines on immigration, sparking a war between the pragmatists and the nativists who just want to shout, "Get out," regardless of political consequences. Republicans are at a crossroads, said Ben Dominic in TheFederalist.com. Trump is tapping into a widespread anger among white working-class Americans who feel culturally, politically, and economically marginalized. Republicans must now decide, do we remain a broad coalition with mainstream appeal, representing everyone who believes in freedom and limited government? Or does the party follow Trump's lead and embrace grievance-based identity politics for white people? For Republicans and the future of the nation, the stakes could not be much higher. It was a good week for ratings after GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump resumed his war with Fox News host Megyn Kelly, saying her show was better when she was on vacation and retweeting an attack that she was a bimbo. Fox News chief Roger Ailes called Trump's comments crude and irresponsible and demanded he apologize. It was a bad week for or excuse me, a good week for censorship after pop star Justin Bieber's handlers banned him from doing live interviews to promote his new album out of concern that the 21-year-old will embarrass himself. And it was a good week for all 7.1 billion Earthlings after NASA officials announced that there is not one shred of evidence to support internet-fueled rumors that a massive asteroid will strike the Earth this September. The killer asteroid doesn't exist, the space agency said. But it was a bad week for not giving up after a Colorado man was arrested for allegedly trying to catch a flight he missed by bursting through a locked door, chasing the closed plane, and demanding to be let in as it was being towed to the runway. It was a bad week for exposing kids to art after a 12-year-old Taiwanese boy on a museum tour tripped and put his fist through a 350-year-old masterpiece by Italian artist Paolo Porpora, worth $1.5 million. And it was a bad week for life imitating art after the mafia staged an elaborate funeral for a well-known mob boss in Rome, replete with 500 mourners, rose petals dropped from a helicopter, and the theme from The Godfather. Rome cannot be defaced by those who want it to become the set of The Godfather, one official complained. Onto the briefing page now. A new way of doing business. Millions of people are getting paid to share cars, homes, and services with people who need them. Is that all good? What is the sharing economy? Coined in Silicon Valley, the term refers to collaborative consumption, the phenomenon of people sharing cars, apartments, power tools, and other underused assets with people willing to pay for them. Companies have sprung up to serve as matchmakers between sellers and buyers. Most famously, Uber, a car service that pairs riders with nearby drivers. Airbnb, which helps people rent out homes and apartments. And TaskRabbit, a web platform that outsources odd jobs to people in your neighborhood. These companies all take a cut of the transaction. Uber, for example, gets 30% of the driver's fee. The new arrangements give providers a flexible source of extra income and users quick access to cheaper goods and services, available 24/7 through apps on their smartphones. 5 years ago, consumers were very skeptical about sharing services, says Rachel Botsman, author of What's Mine is Yours, a book on the sharing economy. People were saying, I'm not going to trust a stranger with my car, or how could you let just anyone into your home? That attitude, she says, has changed to, I never realized how much money I could make or how much money I could save. How did it all start? With the advent of the internet and its limitless potential to connect people around the globe, one of the most significant groundbreakers was Napster, the music sharing service that shut down in 2001 after a copyright infringement suit, but sparked a revolution in the way people consume music. Uber, launched in 2009, has exploded into a $40 billion worldwide company, and its chief competitor, Lyft, now operates in about 65 U.S. cities. Airbnb founder Brian Chesky started out by renting three air mattresses. Now his web service features listings in 190 countries, offering up space in everything from tree houses to castles. Online marketplaces such as Vinted and Poshmark allow people to sell or swap unwanted clothes and accessories. Dog Vacay lets you board your pet in a loving home instead of a kennel. A survey last year found that 18% of Americans have been consumers in the sharing economy, and of those, 83% says it makes life more convenient and efficient. Is everyone enthusiastic? No. As the sharing economy booms, it's experiencing major growing pains. When it began, the peer-to-peer model had an idealistic, egalitarian aura. But critics have begun to see a darker side to the sharing economy, and some call the term itself a misnomer. Actually, it's anti-sharing because they are commodifying resources that before would have been shared for free. Like, if you had a spare room in your house, you would invite some friends, said Michael Bowens, founder of the P2P Foundation, a research group on peer-to-peer interactions. In some cities, people have even tried to make money by taking up multiple parking spaces on public streets and auctioning them off via apps. Cities have cracked down on these services. Turning everything into a commodity to be sold doesn't sound like the sharing economy, said Brooklyn Law School professor Jonathan Askin. It sounds like the selfish economy. Government regulators have also charged that some of these startups endanger the public. Why is the government concerned? Sharing startups often operate under the radar, evading consumer protection laws and regulations. In the case of Airbnb, regulators say that many of its listings aren't by individual homeowners and renters, but by professional landlords taking advantage of higher day rates, essentially running de facto hotels, prohibited in many municipalities. Escort services, meanwhile, have been known to rent out Airbnb apartments to conduct business. It's more discreet and much cheaper than the Waldorf, said New York City sex worker explained. In several cities, Uber and Lyft drivers have been accused of sexually assaulting passengers. And last week, Los Angeles and San Francisco prosecutors charged that Uber had failed to screen out 25 drivers with criminal records who'd given thousands of rides. New business models do not give companies a license to mislead consumers about issues affecting their safety, said San Francisco District Attorney George Gachon. What about the new jobs created? The sharing economy is also called the gig economy because it involves on-demand freelance work without benefits, health care, paid vacation, sick leave, and a retirement plan, and workplace protections associated with a steady job. Most sharing economy companies insist they're not employers, but middlemen facilitating transactions between individuals. Former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich finds that argument disingenuous. The big money goes to the corporations that own the software, he says. The scraps go to the on-demand workers. But Simon Rothman of the venture capital firm Greylock Partners argues that sharing economy jobs are ideal for what he calls uncollared workers, enabling them to work when they want to work and do the job that they want to do. That arrangement isn't for everyone, but for those who don't want full-time jobs, he says, it's a great option. The Uber Wars. If Uber is the face of the sharing economy, it's taken a lot of blows to the chin. In New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio tried unsuccessfully to limit the number of Uber cars, claiming they were jamming already overcrowded streets. Plaintiffs in Texas have filed suits, claiming the company and its competitor Lyft are violating the Americans with Disabilities Act by failing to accommodate wheelchair users. And in June, the California Labor Commission ruled in favor of Barbara Ann Berwick, a San Francisco Uber driver who sued for $4,152 in expenses, claiming she was an employee, not an independent contractor. Uber has appealed, maintaining its drivers embrace their independence. The number one reason drivers choose to use Uber, a spokeswoman said, is because they have complete flexibility and control. But as sharing economy companies grow large, the way Uber has, they begin to seem like conventional businesses. And that's when they attract unwanted attention from lawyers and government regulators. And we'll take a look at the columns now. First two from the U.S., starting with the troll who ran for president. If Donald Trump's rhetoric sounds familiar, said Ann Applebaum, it should be. He's the first presidential candidate in history who uses the language of an internet troll. Trump embodies the ethos of an era in which Twitter, Reddit, extremist blogs, and comments sections daily spew forth personal insults, racist slurs, and vendetta-driven vitriol. Only a troll would snidely question John McCain's war hero status, call Mexican criminals and rapists, and dismiss a female TV reporter as a bimbo. Like the trolls, the billionaire real estate magnate happily invents statistics, claiming, for example, that the real unemployment rate is 42%. He dismisses dull things like budgets, legislation, and foreign policy, and hurls mindless insults. What a loser, at anyone who dares to challenge him. His popularity doesn't stem from any coherent political message. It's about rage expressed in terms usually found in disjointed, all-caps rants at the bottom of web articles. After years of living on the margins, sarcastic hate tweeters, anti-everything nihilists, and conspiracy theorists finally have a voice in national politics. His name is Donald Trump. New Orleans charter school success. New Orleans has proved that public charter schools can produce spectacular results, said Jonathan Chait. After Hurricane Katrina devastated the city, New Orleans decided to totally reinvent its failing neighborhood-based public school system and replace it with a network of public charter schools. The charters have open admissions, so kids from poor neighborhoods are not grouped in one place. New teachers and administrators were brought in and were held accountable for kids' improvement, without the usual union protections that keep mediocre teachers in classrooms. The results have been nothing less than astonishing. A huge gap between New Orleans schools and those from more affluent areas has nearly closed. The percentage of students performing at grade level has soared from 25% to 62%, just shy of the statewide average. Graduation and college entry rates have also jumped. After 50 years of failed educational experiments among poor urban districts, New Orleans has achieved a revolutionary breakthrough, proving that good schools can develop the academic potential of the most underprivileged children. How sad that teachers' unions continue to deny that it's even possible. And this from Poland. The kids who won't be born. The government is effectively robbing single women of their children, said Eva Sidleka. This summer, Poland passed a law regulating in vitro fertilization, a procedure that has been legal but largely unregulated for years. The law, which takes effect in November, applies only to partnered heterosexual women and does not mention the frozen embryos that single women have already created using sperm from anonymous donors. Now, the health ministry informs us that those women will not be allowed to implant their own embryos until they can prove there is a father waiting in the wings to take custody. So that's it for these potential children. If their mothers never partner up, the embryos will be either donated for adoption or destroyed. The ministry pretends it is thinking about the welfare of the children, but there is an amazing lack of consistency about the ethics in this law. Healthy single women are denied IVF, yet there is no age limit for married women who will be allowed to conceive even if postmenopausal and in ill health. In such cases, apparently, Poland is not worried about the fate of the children. This inconsistent law manages to be against the embryos, against the mothers, and against logic. We turn now to the last word, our in-depth article, which is also about New Orleans. It's titled, Rebirth and Resentment in New Orleans. Amid an influx of money and newcomers, said Manuel Roy Francia, some locals worry about the city's soul. On the sliver by the river, the stretch of precious high ground snug against the Mississippi, tech companies sprout up in gleaming towers, swelling with 20-somethings from New England or the Plains who saw the floods only in pictures. A new $1 billion medical center rises downtown. Tourism has rebounded. The music and restaurant scenes are sizzling. And the economy has been buoyed by billions of federal dollars. New Orleans is now swaddled in 133 miles of sturdier levees and flood walls, and it boasts the world's biggest drainage pumping station. But on the porch stoops of this place so comfortable with the cycles of death and decay, they still talk about living in some kind of Atlantis in waiting, as if the cradle of jazz might still slip beneath the sea. 10 years after Hurricane Katrina slashed and snarled into New Orleans on August 29, 2005, newcomers take their juice with chai seeds and buy fixer-uppers, and longtime locals fret that the city is no longer theirs, that it's too expensive and might lose its soul. A city some feared might be left for dead when 80% of its footprint was submerged and is undergoing a social, economic, and cultural evolution. Yet it is still a place deeply tied to its ancient traditions and rites, stubbornly and proudly unique. In the Lower Ninth Ward and in eastern New Orleans, the shells of houses wrecked by Katrina still rot in the humidity, caved-in roofs and teetering walls sharing blocks with homes that got put back together, lifted onto concrete stilts, and re-inhabited. Yet the city's very survival as an inviting and vibrant space has made it into a symbol of resilience, an inspiration for other places savaged by nature's whims and man's mistakes, and the intractability of some of its problems, some of which existed before the storm but have worsened or stagnated since, has made it a magnet for the world's tinkerers, thinkers, and doers. I say New Orleans is the nation's most immediate lab for innovation and change, Mayor Mitch Landreau observes one afternoon. Some people call that an experiment, some a lab. We call it necessity. The suggestion that New Orleans is a petri dish sits uncomfortably with some people. The long-term impact of the conversion of its schools to an all-charter system and the decision to demolish large public housing developments in favor of new mixed-use housing will be debated for years. The rising cost of living has flipped some of the city's neighborhoods from majority black to majority white. Rents have soared, and by one estimate, home sales prices have climbed more than 40% in 10 years. But the people who now populate the city aren't necessarily the ones who fled it. The chocolate city that the bungling and corrupt Katrina-era mayor, Ray Nagin, famously described in the wake of Katrina, is still majority black. But its African-American population has shrunk by nearly 100,000 to 59% from 67%. African-Americans who have returned have also been less likely to share in the abundance. The gap between the median income of blacks and whites grew by 18% after the storm. And the number of African-American children living in poverty jumped from 44% to more than 51%. On Ursulines Avenue in the Treme neighborhood, there's a pretty little side hall shotgun house with olive trim and a porch painted roof. Excuse me, a porch painted red. Buying that house in a neighborhood that embodies the African-American culture of New Orleans, a place where they send off the dead from Chabanet Funeral Home with its trombones and trumpets, high-stepping and back-jumping, buck-jumping, came with a tangle of emotions for Jen Medberry, a child of Connecticut. Medberry, one of the standouts in a post-Hurricane Katrina wave of successful tech entrepreneurs, and her husband are the only white residents on their block. And she's acutely aware of what that means. "I am a gentrifier," Medberry, 31, says. "The presence of outsiders like her is shifting the dynamic of what New Orleans is," says Medberry, who fell hard for the city in her mid-20s while teaching at a charter school in the early years after Katrina, and now runs an education software company. 5 minutes down the road at the opposite end of Treme, Diane Honor, 50, rented half of a brick double across from Louis Armstrong Park a couple of years back. Honor, a licensed practical nurse, is one of the New Orleans Baby Dolls, a group of women who march during carnival season as part of a tradition that dates back to the defiant side street parades of segregation-era black prostitutes. Honor's landlord called a few weeks ago to tell her she had to go. The house was going to be sold. Honor, who lived in Texas after being flooded out, just got gentrified. 6 years after coming home, she says. Some days you feel like your culture is still drowning. On the Friday before Mardi Gras, Patrick Comer and 150 of his friends, entrepreneurs all, spilled out of Arnaud's, a venerable French Quarter restaurant, and onto Bourbon Street. The Friday luncheon is a carnival season tradition. In another era, Comer, founder of Federated Sample, a digital market research company, might have been angling to join one of the city's old line crews or carnival societies. It might have been his entree into the social and business upper crust. But Comer, a 41-year-old Alabamian, hasn't bothered. He and other investors, many from out of state, but some upstart locals too, have launched their own carnival society. They call it the Crew de Nu, which is pronounced new, precisely the identity and message they hope to transmit to the world. Investors have taken notice of the influx, pumping money into New Orleans startups. Forbes recently named New Orleans America's biggest brain magnet. The city saw startups launched at a 64% higher rate than the national average from 2011 to 2013, according to the Data Center, an independent research group. New Orleans as a magnet for new business would have sounded like a fantasy a decade ago. It was a very insular community that was scared of new people, said Tim Williamson, a New Orleans native who runs a business incubator called Idea Village. The day after Katrina, everybody became an entrepreneur. Keith Weldon Medley smiled at first. It looked so charming, all those people driving slowly through Burgundy Street, through the Faubourg, Margigny, and Bywater neighborhoods, pointing cameras. Then it dawned on him these folks weren't tourists or architecture buffs. They were shoppers. And on their shopping list was almost everything that could be had in these neighborhoods. A collection of Creole cottages, shotgun doubles, warehouses, and small manufacturers at a humpback bend of the Mississippi River. In the evolution of post-Katrina New Orleans, few phenomena have been more striking than the dramatic demographic shift of places such as Bywater from majority black to majority white. One census block group in Bywater dropped from 51% African American before Katrina to just 17% afterward. The largest went from 63% to 32%, according to an analysis of U.S. Census data. You saw all these white people. Obviously, they were displacing black people who were here before, said Medley, an African-American historian who lives up in the Marigny house where he grew up. Post-Katrina New Orleans feels like a conundrum to Medley, a city that is safer and more prosperous, but empty of many of the people he'd known for decades. We have hipsters now, said Medley. A few months ago, vandals broke windows and spray-painted Yuppie equals bad on a nearby St. Roch market, a shiny symbol of the New Orleans recovery that had been closed for years after it flooded. The market, which opened in 1875, sold po' boys and shrimp by the pound in an atmosphere of rotting charm before Katrina. It now houses pricey food stalls. And though the vandals were roundly condemned, they also sparked a conversation about the identity of the city post-Katrina, and particularly about the character of poor neighborhoods. After Katrina, there was a rush to buy up properties in the sliver-by-the-river neighborhoods, such as the Marigny and Bywater, anything that didn't flood. Now Robin Halverson, a co-owner of the iconic Bywater Bar of Vaughn's, can walk down almost any street and point to houses where someone is gone. Halverson's favorite neighbor was an old gentleman named Mr. Singleton. He was a stoop sitter, a constant in the Bywater neighborhood where she has lived for decades. He couldn't keep up with the taxes, she said, and sold his place. Some people from up north bought it. They fixed it. They made it pretty. They're nice, Halverson says, but they're not stoop sitters. Out on Benefit Street in the Upper Ninth Ward, there's a China ball tree where Mr. Phil's house once stood. Now it's just a patch of grass. It's as good a spot as any to drink a beer on a Tuesday afternoon, but at night you wouldn't go near it. Night, said Ernest Lyons, an appliance repairman who lives nearby, is when the zombies come out, the crackheads of this troubled neighborhood bounded by canals and railroad tracks, northeast of the city center. Up the road, there's a set of concrete stairs that leads to nowhere. But someone lives across the street. There's a tricycle in the driveway, and the air conditioner hums. It goes on like this for block after block. An empty foundation next to a spruced-up place with bright, clean siding, next to a sagging wreck with a hole in the roof, next to a house with a brand-new deck. Jesse Perkins, a 54-year-old sewer manager who grew up in the Desire public housing development, lives across the street from a large seniors' apartment complex that was devastated during Katrina and now sits 10 years later with caved-in roofs and smashed-out windows. He's gotten used to the sound of junkies rustling around inside. He'll never get used to the gunshots in the distance. A city long plagued by violence hit a 43-year low in its murder rate in 2014, according to Mayor Landreau's office. But this year there's been a spike in violence, and the city registered its 100th murder nearly 2 months earlier than the year before. The city, on balance, is far better off than before Katrina, says the writer Jason Berry, who's accustomed to the nightly symphony of sirens that has spread beyond the poorest sections. But it's still a break-your-heart kind of town. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. On the health and science page now, old mines leaking toxic sludge. The western U.S. is littered with tens of thousands of abandoned mines filled with toxic sludge like the one that recently turned Colorado's San Juan and Animas rivers an alarming shade of orange, the Wall Street Journal reports. That spill inadvertently caused by an Environmental Protection Agency cleanup crew at the Gold King mine unleashed 3 million gallons of toxic waste, including arsenic, cadmium, copper, lead, and aluminum. The EPA says there are 160,000 abandoned mines throughout the West, and 33,000 of them are already leaking acidic water full of toxins or have piles of toxic tailings that could leach into rivers. The mining industry was largely unregulated until the 1970s, and efforts to clean up mines have faltered because of engineering problems, lack of money, and political battles over who should pay. You can expect many such failures like the one we had at Gold King, said Ron Cohen, an environmental engineer with the Colorado School of Mines. These sites are just sitting there waiting to fail, and most of them are going to fail sooner or later. The EPA estimates the remediation of abandoned mines would cost at least $35 billion. Lonely people wired differently. Pervasive feelings of loneliness can alter the brain, leading isolated people to perceive exaggerated threats and hostility in social situations, reports MedicalDaily.com. Researchers from the University of Chicago monitored the brains of 38 very lonely people and 32 who weren't lonely when they were exposed to words such as party, sad, belong, alone, and joy. The lonely people were much more acutely sensitive to any negativity, showing strong immediate reactions to threatening words. The findings suggest that when lonely people walk into a crowded room, they focus on any negative facial expressions and words while ignoring smiles and words of welcome. Study authors Stephanie and John Capioco said that for evolutionary reasons, being on the social perimeter is not only sad, it is dangerous. As a result, isolated people's brains become hypervigilant for threats. In the health scare of the week, early trauma's lasting damage. Traumatic early life experiences, such as the loss of a loved one, abuse, and divorce, can make changes in brain structure that increase a child's risk for anxiety or depression later on, according to a new study. Scientists followed nearly 500 mothers and their sons from pregnancy until the boys reached adulthood. The mothers answered questions about 37 types of adversity their children had faced at home before age six. The mothers also reported symptoms of anxiety or depression their sons developed by the time they were 7, 10, and 13. Brain scans performed on the boys between 18 and 21 suggest that facing more forms of hardship early in life is associated with lower volume in parts of the brain involved with emotion, decision-making, empathy, and self-awareness, reports Reuters.com. Research suggests that the experiences early in life really matter, especially before the age of five, said Duke University child development researcher Jamie Hansen. On the Talking Points page now, Ashley Madison, a digital stoning of adulterers. Pull up your pants, gents. The game is up, said Nick Mokey in BusinessInsider.com. All 37 million users of the adultery website Ashley Madison, whose marketing slogan advises, "Life is short, have an affair," are now cowering in fear after hackers released the site's registry online. The huge data dump was easily searchable, making it possible to pore over not just names, email addresses, and credit card details of cheating partners, friends, and coworkers, but also the sexual desires they revealed in their Madison profiles. At least one betrayed wife has filed for divorce, with many more to come. The leak has bagged its first celebrity victim, evangelical reality TV star Josh Duggar, who joined the site to find extramarital partners with, quote, natural breasts for bubble baths for two, and who is now boiling in his own hypocritical bright red stew of shame. The internet is gleeful, said Amanda Marcotte in TalkingPointsMemo.com. But we should think twice before wallowing in schadenfreude. Hypocrites who've publicly held themselves up as models of virtue, like Duggar, are fair game. But nearly everyone else in the leak is a private citizen whose sexual choices aren't the world's business. The 37 million users of the site are far more complex than the good, evil characters brandished by the smug moralizers, said Glenn Greenwald in firstlook.org. Some of these folks may have open marriages, and some may have spouses who won't or can't have sex. Are all these people really deserving of full-scale reputational ruin and worse? So far, at least two exposed users have committed suicide, including a San Antonio police captain. There's a bigger picture here, said Caitlin Dewey in WashingtonPost.com. God knows we all have skeletons in our digital closets. You might have sent emails bitching about your boss or best friend, made an online purchase of a sex toy or Viagra, or logged onto a porn site. It's only a matter of time before an ethical hacker decides he should leak that embarrassing material to a gawking public. Technology is apparently too seductive to resist, said Jack Merkinson in Salon.com. So we're surrendering our privacy without much of a fight. No matter how many hacks occur and secrets are revealed, people keep handing over vast quantities of private information via the internet. Today, it's Ashley Madison. Tomorrow, it's us. Iran deal. Confusion over inspections. This is a new one in the history of arms control, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The Associated Press reported last week that under the terms of a secret side agreement between Iran and UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, inspections at the country's Parkin nuclear site will be conducted by, believe it or not, the Iranians themselves. For more than a decade, IAEA inspectors have been trying to gain access to Parkin, which they suspect was the home of Iran's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile development up to about 2003. Yet now it seems that the agency and the Obama administration's architects of the broader nuclear deal are happy to take the mullahs on trust. Naturally, the White House is disputing the details of the AP story, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. But it's clear this administration didn't demand access to the Parkin to find out how close Iran came to building a bomb. This is more damning evidence that the nuclear deal is a farce. Actually, this grand revelation is a lot less damning than it appears, said Max Fisher in Vox.com. The source document leaked to the AP was just a draft, and it appears that the IAEA staff will be present to monitor the Iranians as they take environmental samples at Parkin. It's also important not to conflate the inspections at Parkin, which are solely concerned with Iranian nuclear work that ended years ago, with the considerably more rigorous and intrusive system set up to monitor current activity. Besides, it's highly unlikely that inspectors will learn anything useful from Parkin, said David Sanger in the New York Times. Since it was shut down, the site has been bulldozed and rebuilt to the point that evidence of past work likely has vanished. Nevertheless, the inspection selfie deal should not remain a secret, said William Toby and Judith Miller in RealClearPolitics.com. The Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act explicitly decrees that Congress be given all relevant documents, including deals entered into or made between Iran and other parties. The Parchin Agreement between Iran and the IAEA clearly falls under that category. Lawmakers should refuse to vote until they are told very specifically what's in the side deals between Iran and the IAEA. How else can Congress conduct a rational debate about the deal's virtues and weaknesses? And taking in some of the shorter notes, July was officially the hottest month since records began in 1880, with Earth's average surface temperature hitting 61.86 degrees Fahrenheit. July's average temperature was 1.46 degrees higher than the average for the 20th century and 0.14 degrees above the previous hottest month, which occurred in 1998. At this point in the 2012 presidential campaign cycle, former Texas Governor Rick Perry was leading the Republican field by 1.7 points. At this point in the 2008 cycle, Hillary Clinton was leading Barack Obama by 15.6 points, while Rudy Giuliani was leading the GOP field by 10.7 points. More than one in four new mothers go back to work within 2 weeks of giving birth, according to a newly published study. Most of these new moms work for employers who do not provide paid maternity leave. In a new survey, the World Happiness Report found that the U.S. ranked just 15th. Switzerland, Iceland, and Denmark came out on top. The survey measures such factors as GDP, life expectancy, social connection, and freedom. In the poll watch, 58% of Americans consider themselves haves rather than have-nots, down 1 point from 2008. 38% there say they're have-nots, and the have-nots, while up 45% do. Oh, excuse me. Sorry to say I botched that one. Maybe it's a good time for this quote from Mark Twain. Humor is the good-natured side of truth. And we're out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org.